Well, maybe you suspend judgment about how brilliant it is until it's done. So I'm going to start with just laying some of the background to the treatment of the national and colonial question in the Comintern. So in Russia, Lenin was the person who led the charge that socialists should support the right of self-determination for nations that were oppressed by other nations, including the right to secede from the territory of that oppressing nation. So this wasn't just a kind of fluffy commitment to the equality of nations or different cultures, but saying that if one nation is oppressing another, that nation has the total right to secede. And that was an important differentiation between Bolshevism, between revolutionary Marxism, and social democracy in the international socialist movement, which at best only called for the equality of nations, or at worst called for the retention of the colonies in a so-called progressive colonial policy. And so the Russian Revolution put this national question approach into practice. As the old regime disintegrated in Russia, so did its empire, as countries like Ukraine, Finland, Georgia, and Azerbaijan broke away from central Russian government control. And so during the war, Lenin had also put forward the idea that struggles for national self-determination, particularly in the countries of Asia and Africa, that were facing significant challenges from imperialism or were actually colonized, that could be an integral part of the coming world revolution. And this became the framework for approaching the national and colonial questions in the Communist International, or, you know, the contraction is the Comintern, the organisation that was formed and led by the Bolsheviks to spread the revolution from Russia worldwide. And for their part, there was a huge level of enthusiasm for Soviet Russia in the colonial world, as it had granted self-determination for those countries oppressed by the old Tsarist Empire, and also because Trotsky, during the negotiations to end the war, published all of the secret treaties of the Entente, that were laying claim to various parts of the Middle East. However, this aim of trying to ally with, involve the anti-colonial struggles into the world revolution gave rise to a series of problems that were debated from the time of the Second Comintern Congress that happened in 1920, when Lenin put forward his theses on the national and colonial question that hopefully some people are familiar with. These theses argued that the Comintern aim was to bring about the closest possible alliance with all national and colonial liberation movements and Soviet Russia. All communist parties must directly support the revolutionary movement among the nations that are dependent and do not have equal rights, not only with words, but with deeds. Anything less than this in that framework would mean reverting back to the kind of abstract national equality that was advocated by the Second International, but not a real revolutionary policy. But this gave rise to many questions, I think, regarding the colonies and the semi-colonies. If you've heard that term before, that just means countries that were nominally independent but faced significant military, political, or economic challenges from imperialism. And I think these were questions for which the theses did not have a very clear answer. So just a few. What was the class nature of the national movements, considering, in the context of the social and economic conditions in those countries? Could there be a social revolution in these countries? Or would these countries, which were, in the language of the day, economically backward, have to go through some other means if they were going to modernise and progress? And what would be the form and basis for the alliance that was being suggested, the assistance, the practical assistance that the Comintern and Soviet Russia would provide to the national movements? As I'll go over, these national movements were led by bourgeois, capitalist or petty bourgeois forces whose aims were, on the whole, narrowly nationalist and ultimately anti-socialist. So how would these alliances square that with the aim of building an international communist movement and promoting a specifically socialist revolution worldwide? And what would the main tasks for communists in these countries be? So there's a whole series of questions that are coming from this. So I think that the main thing I want to focus on here is critiquing the policy of alliances between communist organisations on the one hand and nationalist forces on the other. And that critique will be based on the results of those alliances, where they were made between the Comintern and the national movements in Turkey, Persia, Afghanistan, and in China. And it's important to note at the beginning that, you know, in the beginning, in 1920, when Lenin's putting forward these ideas, they operated within the expectation that a workers' revolution in Europe would be imminent, that, you know, at the time they were having to make a series of concessions, retreats, compromises that arose, you know, out of necessity of defending the Soviet state, and that these would be resolved in the near future by a revolutionary working class leadership on a world scale. But as the 20s went on, the perspective of temporary support for nationalist forces soon meshed with the needs of the Soviet state to stabilise its rule through diplomacy and alliances within the international system. And of course, that's getting to the era of Stalin's rise to power within the Russian state. And in that period, the political principles and strategy on the national and colonial question in the Comintern became very distorted by the commitment to protect socialism in one country. So I want to acknowledge before I begin that these questions have received a lot of attention on among historians that are looking at the Comintern at the moment. But unfortunately, I think they obfuscate some of these questions because they're not putting all of these debates into their context. And they have generally an a priori commitment that any discussion of colonialism is good, regardless of what the actual practical results of that discussion was. So to start with the Second Comintern Congress, where these debates first began, I've already outlined the background to Lenin's perspective, but now to delve into the question of alliances and practical support for national movements. So Lenin argued that no matter who these movements were led by, as they were playing a revolutionary role in the world situation by weakening imperialism, there needed to be this practical support. However, the contradiction that's written into this perspective, as I've said, and I want to explore more now, is the incompatibility in aims between nationalist and communist politics. National movements, as they arose, were not led by communist parties, which mostly in these countries didn't exist yet, but were naturally led by bourgeois, petty bourgeois forces, or even very traditional sectors of society, and they had nationalist politics. So what did that mean? Their aim was to establish independent capitalist states and to engage in economic development. Some of these people were secular modernizers, others were moderate Islamists, but by definition, all of these you know, nationalist leaders felt entitled to occupy a ruling position in the new independent society that they're trying to create. It's important to say as well that some of these nationalist forces already held state power. This was the case in Turkey, for example, which is an example that I want to return to throughout. It meant that they behaved more or less like other states. Some actually had expansionist aims, like Turkey. Others sought to play imperialist powers against one another, and they had no a priori commitment to fight imperialism, let alone a fight for socialism. So in Turkey, that was led by the Young Turks since 1908. They made a wartime alliance with German imperialism in the hope that they could save, you know, save some of the extent of the Ottoman Empire. Quite famously, or infamously, they'd also committed the Armenian Genocide in eastern Anatolia in the course of that war. So it's not like Lenin was unaware of the incompatibility between communist and nationalist politics. So he argued that communist forces in the colonies or the Comintern itself should make a distinction between communist and nationalist politics and keep organisationally separate from nationalist forces when engaged in this alliance, which he said could only be temporary because of that ultimate incompatibility between aims. So the communists were to be educated to be conscious of their particular tasks, that is, the task of struggling against a bourgeois democratic movement in their own nation. But in practice, it was difficult to keep this separation and struggle against bourgeois nationalism because even if the alliance was temporary, it was still an alliance. So even with the saying that communists shouldn't dissolve into the national movement, the risks to working class independence were of this policy were pretty substantial. It's interesting at the first, in the second Congress where this is raised, it's the Italian Socialist Party delegation to Congress that raises this hesitation, including amendments to Lenin's theses to weaken the support for national movements. However, the issues were all very complicated in that debate because these Italian socialists were mostly centrists, and it just came across like a simple refusal to support colonial liberation from socialists who refused to break with reformism in their countries. But the broader perspective of an alliance with Bush nationalist movements became a point of debate with Indian communist M.N. Roy. He pointed to the existence of nationalist movements that were not meaningfully trying to, destroy imperialism on a global level at all. So in his country, India, the Indian Congress is the key organisation here. Congress was very, very reluctant to involve the mass of peasants and workers in the national struggle at all at this point. They were potentially willing as well to compromise with imperialism and curtail the national struggle because they felt imperialism could better harbour their interests in a lot of cases than a mass disruptive struggle for independence. So in response to Roy, a distinction was made therefore between national reformist and national revolutionary movements, where national reformist movements were, predisposed to meet the imperialist powers halfway, and the national revolutionary ones wanted a more uncompromising struggle against imperialism. However, this posed a bit of this kind of new delineation raised more problems than it really solved. Because, for example, the Indian National Congress did lead a mass struggle involving like workers and peasants not long after this distinction was made. And sections of Congress did favour raising some social demands of the peasantry in an effort to modernise India. A similar point could be made about Sun Yat-sen's Kuomintang in China. This is a very bourgeois organisation. It formed among Republican layers in the army, and it had support of the chambers of commerce in various cities. However, it did transform itself into a leading national organisation with a lot of support from workers and peasants that took up its calls to go on strike and that kind of thing. So what was the nature? Was this a national revolutionary organisation? Well, we'll see. The reality that Roy began to point to was that no matter how mass these nationalist organisations were or willing to selectively take up the grievances of the mass of the population, their leadership still remained bourgeois in their aims. So even those that were combative towards Western imperialism were not at all amenable to the social demands of the mass of people in these countries. And this risked, this national revolutionary designation risked accepting that the communist colouring, basically, that these forces gave themselves, despite Lenin's warnings in these theses to not give these forces a kind of more communist gloss than they deserve. And an example of that is that the Kuomintang sent a delegate to a congress that the Comintern put on for Toilers of the East in 1922, and that delegate characterised the Kuomintang as a communist party in all but name. So much of the thinking about the alliance between the Comintern and national movements was the analysis that was really shared by all figures, no matter what their the stances were on the questions that I've gone through so far, that there couldn't be a social revolution in the colonies and that the anti-colonial revolution would be in the kind of bourgeois democratic stage, preceding a kind of stage in which social revolution was possible. And that was based on a reading that the colonies and the semi-colonies were far too economically backward, their conditions were still feudal, to permit a social revolution or even have the possibility of serious working class political action, as there was little industrialisation and only a very small working class. And this is true in some places. It would have been very difficult to see a revolutionary crisis develop in which the working class could play a leading role. But importantly, not all countries, as I'll return to. But the impossibility of social revolution in some of these colonies in the eyes of the Comintern was important because it was the basis for arguing that there had to be an alliance between communist and bourgeois nationalism in these countries. The proletariat was far too weak to achieve leadership over the national movement. And for Lenin, as I've said, this doesn't mean that they're going to be subordinate to bourgeois politics, But it did circumscribe what was deemed to be possible in these countries. Crucially, all, including Lenin, kind of assumed that the nationalist bourgeoisie were playing a progressive role in their context, as independence would allow them to modernise society. And he also, I think, overestimated how democratic the commitments of some of these forces were. So, for example, after the 1911 revolution in China brought Sun Yat-sen to power, Lenin described him as a revolutionary democrat who showed that in Asia there is still a bourgeoisie capable of championing sincere, militant, consistent democracy, a worthy comrade of France's great men of the entitlement, enlightenment. however, there was a slide from that kind of, I think, misguided thinking to a bit of Comintern identification with bourgeois aims. So, for example, by mid-1923, the Soviet foreign minister said, "Our policy has been directed to facilitate the process of the emergence and self-consciousness of the bourgeoisie in the countries of the East as a force capable of building up a powerful barrier against the imperialist ambitions of British and other capital." Moreover, accepting that the anti-colonial revolution in backwards countries belonged to this separate bourgeois democratic stage accepted that working class aims needed to be postponed to a later stage. And even agrarian grievances, so the grievances of like peasants, particularly the poor peasants, received similar treatment as time went on, as the fight against the external enemy became what they defined as the key task for this stage. It's important to say that this picture of a completely backwards economic and social conditions was not the case universally across the colonies, and this is something that M.N. Roy emphasised more and more as time went on. So in India and China, places that had had substantial industrial development, particularly during World War I, you know, not evenly at all, but, you know, there was actually a small but important proletariat in these countries. So examining the situation in these countries, Roy thought that the basis for a social revolution was developing, but that the national revolution had to come first for the subjective forces for that to be built. Nevertheless, I think by identifying the development of this separate movement of workers and peasants that was not mobilised by the nationalists and directed against exploiters, whether foreign or local, that was going on in both China and India, Roy made a pretty big advance on the tendency to see the colonies as one, you know, united nation behind bourgeois leadership. And regardless of whether social revolutions were on the cards in these countries, it was untenable, I think, for small groups of communists in these countries to just ignore social divisions in order to ally with the bourgeois nationalists, you know, for a short amount of time, for a relatively longer amount of time. It still created a situation where the Comintern and Soviet Russia and, you know, the communist parties in these countries were allied with bourgeois nationalists while there were class struggles directed, at least partly, against the social base of some of these parties, bourgeois nationalist parties. So what should the tasks of communists in the colonies and the semi-colonies actually be? So there wasn't a strict prescription of this at the Second Comintern Congress, but there was a debate about this. So Roy advocated for the building of communist parties as crucial for the national movement and the class struggle to come. He had raised that the beginnings of a strike movement in India were a new field for, through which the communist parties could be built there. And he cited the importance of building communist parties as, you know, independence would someday be achieved. But the nationalist bourgeoisie should not just be able to, like, run the newly independent nation without a challenge. And so the building of communist parties was very important. However, Radek and others in the Comintern opposed him from the Congress on the Congress floor, again on the basis that the economic preconditions didn't exist. You know, it can our assistance to these countries can only take the form of direct assistance to the liberation struggles of these peoples, aka like the bourgeois nationalist movements. So now's a good time, I think, to acknowledge that other reasons were developing for prioritising political support for nationalists, And that was the defence and stabilisation of Soviet Russia. So initially this was, of course, tied up with the advance of the revolution. There was no way that world revolution was going to spread if the worker state in Russia was overthrown. But this goal gradually came apart from the aim of promoting world revolution as the decade progressed and prospects for revolution in the advanced capitalist countries, mainly in Europe, became more remote. Stabilisation of Russia's position both internally and externally became more of an overriding aim. Russia had to sit within the existing system of states and within the global capitalist economy, and that kind of became, that survival became an aim in and of itself. And usually historians, when they consider this factor when it comes to the colonies, they focus on the dropping of anti-British agitation in the Middle East by the Comintern when they signed a trade treaty in 1921. But equally, the treaties that Soviet Russia signed with Persia, Afghanistan and Turkey, you know, despite their repression of local communists, were a sign of this. Yes. Sorry, I seem to have like totally lost the part where I actually explained what the repression of those communists were, but let me see if I can get to it. The geopolitical needs of the Russian state would become increasingly a factor in discussions about the national and colonial question in another sense, because then the call for alliances with nationalists became the justification for these kind of more diplomatic and military alliances for the defence of Russia. So, for example, there was an alliance with Turkey, and the Turkish state that I said was run by the Young Turks. They, as soon as they had kind of gotten what they wanted from Soviet Russia in terms of military assistance and aid, turned towards repressing the enemy from within. So they were fighting Britain, they got the aid from Russia, but then as soon as that wasn't necessary anymore, they turned around and repressed the peasant, workers and communist movements in their countries. So the most infamous example of that was that Turkish communists formed a party while they were in Russia in 1920, and then because they thought that the national movement would be a place where that communist party could be harboured and grow, they decided to go back to Turkey. It's very likely that they were disappeared and murdered with the knowledge of the Kemal government there. And yet the Soviet state then signed an alliance with Turkey, a treaty with Turkey, not long afterwards. All right. Okay. So how do these factors impact the continuing debate within the Comintern that I was tracking before? So Roy continued to advance his argument. He basically didn't stop advancing this argument in the Comintern while he still had any influence in it. So he argued that it was the working class by 1921, not the bourgeoisie, that was the revolutionary class now and into the future, and that communists should orient hard towards the struggle against both foreign and local exploiters in a kind of dual struggle. However, in the 1921 Third Congress, these differences of opinion were not hashed out at all, and a statement from a Young Turk was actually read out to the conference floor. And Zinoviev responded with what can only be termed a kind of apology to their behaviour of the Kemal government, saying that we still have to travel alongside these forces for some time. So I think this was a key example of the theoretical and political mistake of allying with nationalists intersecting with the needs of the Russian state for an ally in its near region. These complications only increased at the Fourth Congress in 1922. The kind of scholars of the Comintern really focus on the concept of the anti-imperialist united front that emerges at this Congress. But this anti-imperialist united front, which is basically the name for what I've been describing so far, is problematic in a whole series of ways. It made a comparison to the united front in Europe, despite explicitly including, you know, nationalist movements led by bourgeois and petty bourgeois forces, and not only other working class parties. The policy was also kind of ambiguous, so all sides of the debate, you know, over the alliance with bourgeois nationalism felt that they had to kind of adhere to it. So Roy emphasised much more the need for communist independence in such an alliance, the need to appeal to the social grievances of the working class and the peasantry, and the need to transcend bourgeois nationalist ideology eventually take the national movement under Communist Party leadership at some point, which is an important part of the United Front in Europe. But then Radek was able to define the anti-imperialist United Front as demanding support for the bourgeois classes despite the class antagonisms in those countries, precluding the class struggle and postponing it to some point in the future. And at this Congress, Roy advanced his strongest argument yet against the alliances with nationalism, including a specific critique of the Comintern relations with the Turkish movement. However, these objections to this alliance were completely ignored by the responses from Radek and other Comintern leaders. The Turkish state was once more supported by Radek despite everything. And actually, Radek, who I should probably say is a very key leader in the Comintern at this time, even ridiculed Roy for being unsuccessful in building a communist party, and also ridiculed Chinese communist delegates for what he characterised as their doctrinaire approach, but was actually them trying to defend the policy of focusing on building purely communist parties in China at the time. And in that way, he bolstered an argument that only through the united front with the bourgeoisie, by carrying their historical obligations to the revolutionary bourgeois forces, our comrades succeeded in establishing themselves among the working masses of North China. So we're getting now into the period of the rise of Stalin in the Comintern and the start of the faction fights. And this meant all of these tendencies I've been talking about were amplified and multiplied like tenfold. So Turkey continued to bear this out. Turkey and the Soviet Union grew closer in 1925, and they signed a treaty of friendship. But then Kemal basically took this as a signal that he was safe to then engage in further repression of the Communist Party, imprisoning 17 communist activists, a total of 159 years. And placing trade unions under his own control in 1926. And Lenin had assigned bourgeois nationalism as a temporarily revolutionary factor in the context of imperialism, as I've talked about. But in this period, however, Stalin himself started to characterise the bourgeoisie as a class in these countries as objectively revolutionary. And this is one of the key terms through which this policy was defended going forward. So, you know, this one statement about the Egyptian nationalists is kind of indicative. He says that in spite of the bourgeois origin and bourgeois status of the leaders of the Egyptian national movement, they are objectively revolutionary in spite of the fact that they are against socialism. So, in the Fifth Congress that happened in 1924, this is when Roy starts to get blowback rather than just being ignored by the Comintern leaders. So it really matches up with the period of the rise of Stalin. He was criticised by a Comintern leader for his deviations, that's kind of the language of the time, and for exaggerating the social movement in the colonies at the expense of the national movement. Basically, after this, he never recovered the influence he lost from this attack. And the Comintern leaders essentially attempted to transfer his responsibility for the Indian communists to the Communist Party of Great Britain. So just to turn to something just quickly that I raised at the start, which is that historians of the Comintern and the colonial question really tend to focus on this period of all periods as like the best period for Comintern anti-colonialism. So if you've read Brigitte Studer's book, Travellers of the World Revolution, which was on the reading list for this conference, or Alexa Drakowicz's book as well, which is called Left Transnationalism, they talk about the League Against Imperialism established by Willy Munzenberg in Berlin as being like evidence that there was a kind of renewed focus on colonialism at this question, and they really celebrate that. But I think, you know, as much as the League might have raised questions of anti-colonial solidarity in Europe, to examine what was really going on in this period regarding the anti-colonial struggle, the enormous potential and catastrophic defeat for the workers in the Communist Party of China in 1927 has to be the starting point. So as Stalin had allied with Bukharin as the new leader of the Comintern, the policy of support not only for Sun Yat-sen, but especially military leader Chiang Kai-shek, was increased in the name of the anti-imperialist United Front. And when the Shanghai massacres destroyed the front with Chiang, the left Kuomintang leader was embraced instead, which went down to the same end. So basically, there was a murder of thousands of anti-colonial working class activists at the same time as these historians are focused on the League Against Imperialism in Europe. So that's very not useful. So I'll start to wrap up now because we've gotten to the era of high Stalinism, where basically Stalin is taking control directly over the Comintern and really sidelining Bukharin and his previous allies. And again, some of these historians look at this period as a period of militant anti-colonial struggle. But the reality was that even though the anti-imperialist United Front was ditched in this period, just like the United Front in Europe, there was a policy basically of just completely isolating the communist parties from any of like the mass organisations and movements that had developed in the colonies at that time. And an example of this was the workers and peasants parties that were springing up in India that Roy said they should try and orient to and ally with. For this, he was basically attacked as a reformist and sidelined from the Comintern completely. And of course, in China, after the devastation that was wrought on the communist movement under the anti-imperialist United Front, Stalin tried to make up for that by organising a whole series of ultra-left putsches, which just finished off the remaining communist organisations. So this turn to the left or militant anti-colonial struggle was just as devastating. But despite the apparent radicalism of the third period, they never dropped the objectively revolutionary role for the bourgeoisie. And that was later resuscitated in the middle of the 1930s, where they swung again to a policy of class collaboration and the Popular Front. So bourgeois and petty bourgeois nationalists were never broken with at any point by the Stalinists to engage in independent working class action that could challenge imperialism across borders. And we've been telling the story, I think, of the results of this in other sessions throughout the conference, such as the session on Ho Chi Minh earlier this morning. The Stalinized communist parties themselves became the bearer of this nationalist politics on a whole bunch of occasions and then gave them the communist colouring that Lenin and Roy and others were so keen to avoid. And the tragedy was that nationalist politics in many cases postponed the moment of national liberation, but more seriously meant that these countries were inherited by a new ruling class that exploited their workers in an attempt to pursue a stronger position for their nation in the international system. So this is a massive sideways step, really, for the struggle of the liberation of the mass of people in the colonies. None of this was, of course, I don't want to, having traced the history and the development of this, I'm not trying to say that this was predestined from the moment of Lenin and other Comintern leaders' mistaken support for the alliances with bourgeois nationalists. It did, of course, have its strengths, as I've discussed. It was a statement of possibility in a moment of world revolution. But as I've argued, the degeneration of the Russian Revolution was a critical factor that meant that more positive sides to it could never be resolved and realised. But rather than embrace the Comintern approach as the final word on the practical application of socialist support for national self-determination, I think we need to look critically at how these things progress and really critique the idea of alliances and critical support for bourgeois nationalism.